again, I'll wrestle with the meaning of this one a little bit. It says, won't a ministry of warning borderline on self-righteousness?
Well, it could. That's attitude. But you have a Philippians 2 attitude. You warn in love. You warn according to Galatians 6:1 with a spirit of humility, knowing that you yourself can be fall into the same sin. No, the ministry of warning is a scriptural ministry. We have to do it because we're in a sinful world. Most of the commands are negative commands, sorry, but that's what a sinful world is like. So really a lot of work of an elder, a lot of work of the elder is really admonition and warning. You learn to do it with grace. You learn to do it with skill, in love. People know you love them, but it's part of the daily grind. And sometimes we get into situations of how are we going to tell them what we have to tell them without them getting angry or leaving the church, but you have to do it. Just have to do it. And be committed to loving confrontation. Most men hate confrontation, but confrontation is part of leadership. Leaders who can't confront normally see things get real bad. And a good church will be a church where men are confronting problems and problem issues. And remember, when we don't confront problems, they just come back bigger, different way. Hopefully you're skillful and you're tactful and you're not hurting people.
Okay, I think this is the last question, and if we didn't get yours, or I've rounded something off too much, speak up. Don't embarrass yourself, not the idea at all, but this question says, what are some ways to keep a wall of separation from building between the elders and the rest of the believers in the assembly?
Yes, this would really come under what I was talking about earlier, under the elders' meeting. Communication, communication, communication. Good communication, even between the elders. And it's just like in a marriage, right? What do they say? Most marriages break down because of a lack of communication. You have to work at that all the time. And again, many of us men are just very poor at that. So that means we've got to do the double effort. And I would say this, Dick. I get a lot of phone calls about... In fact, I get phone calls every single day. My wife's here. She can tell you at least once or twice a day from churches asking questions. A lot of questions about church discipline, by the way. And I find that one of the biggest problems in church discipline is that the leadership body is not communicating with the congregation, and the people getting very angry and feel in the dark. You've just got to overdo communication to make sure people know what you're thinking. And we elders think that people know what we're thinking. They don't. They often feel in the dark. Now, let me tell you about a great church in Pennsylvania with a very large church, 2,500-member church, fully elder-led. Been in it several times. They put every month, they have a special thing in the bulletin that says all the major things the elders were talking about, things they ask the congregation to pray for them that they're deciding on. And very open policy, and invite lots of people to the elders' meetings for the key leaders. They just really try to work hard at keeping the congregation formed. Now, what we created in our church was a thing we call chat time. After the Lord's Supper, we have about a 15-minute period of time, and we don't fill it all up with announcements, just one or two announcements. Incidentally, announcements is a great problem in most churches. Just keep them at a bare-bones minimum, put them in the bulletin, shoot them on the overhead, and that's it. I was in a church assembly in California where they asked me to come speak, flew me in and everything, and the man who did the announcements took 20 minutes, left me with 20 minutes to speak, spent all that money, and he went on and on for 20 minutes. I couldn't believe it. It was so boring, and I understand he does it all the time. We have a little chat time every Sunday, and we bring up special prayer requests. We bring people up for prayer. We're going to go have operations. We make it a real family time. It's our family communication time. People who don't come to that do not know what's going on in our church. That's where we talk about our heartbeat. That's where we talk about the things they need to be rebuked about. Like we have a problem on Sunday morning at the second service. Everyone's standing around talking. They will not get out of the way of people coming in and visitors. And it's just utter confusion. And when we try to start the meeting, it's like trying to whip a bunch of cats into line. No one wants to sit down. They all want to talk, which is great. The only problem is someone comes in, they say, boy, this is a noisy gang. So we remind them, go talk all you want. But when we get close to 5 minutes to the starting time, either get outside and talk or else sit down, because it's just so hard for the people to start the meeting. So we have to stay on them on that one because they all love to talk too much. We have problems in the church, so we try to address it during that time. So it's our chat time. It's the elders' time with the congregation. Situations they need to know about. So I think anything we can do to keep communicating over and over again as much as possible and not assume people know what we're thinking or where we're going or what it's all about. They don't. They really don't. The problem is people just being nice to us. And if there is a problem in the church, you got to, then you have to over-communicate. That ends all the suspicions and it ends gossip if you're just right up front. There's a problem in the church going on. Just be up front with it. We ask you to pray about this. Don't talk about it. Pray about it. People get to know if the eldership's an upfront eldership. They get confidence in you if they know. These guys are straight shooters. They'll never tell you anything that's false. And it even means telling about our disagreements. When we elders were divided on something, we brought it to the congregation, said we're divided on it. Two elders presented their position. Had the congregation ask questions and help us work through it. They basically helped the elders work through disagreement. So,
with regards to that, you mentioned several times before about having a lot of people in the elders' meeting. And yet, within the elders' meeting, there is, I don't know if it's a statement, but there is a
private issue.
Sure.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. No, we ask them to be, when we're dealing with confidential matters, someone needs to be exposed as a terrible sin and the elders want our altar to be learned about, we just tell them at that time you have to leave. We usually put that towards the end. And that, but basically all visitors to the elders meeting are asked not to talk about most of the things we talk about because they're not in a position to do that. We don't want them to think they're elders. So they get a paper and the paper tells them, you're here to observe and we ask you not to just say, oh, this didn't happen, that happened. But anything private, they just have to leave. So.
Okay. This it'd be good if we could hear the question. Mark suggested that we just hand this microphone around. So.
How many elders are in our assembly? Seven. I don't think there's any number. I think that's just a matter of what God has given you. I think there's seven deacons too. Just like Act 6. Yeah. In fact, we talked to the deacons about getting some more deacons. They said, we don't want any more deacons. We've got just a number. We can't give any more work. And I said, fine. That's what it's about.
How big is it?
About 300 families. Family units. That's how we usually count. Yeah.
Let me rephrase my question. What translation do you use in your assembly and why?
Well, I'll be frank with you. We use different ones. Some preachers use the NIV. I use the NASB. And some use the New King James Version. Yeah, that's why you notice I put the notes, and when I do my notes on Sunday morning, I normally put my translation in the notes because everyone uses all these different Bibles today. That's why I did it for this conference too.
Well, I see some stares are getting a little blank, and yes.
Okay, the question is if the elder has a particular family problem, like a child is arrested or maybe the girl gets pregnant or something, should that elder step down or should it be brought to the assembly? Well, our elders are very, very, very strict on this subject. And we see any problem in the family, even a potential problem coming, but almost always they will say, you know, step back for a while, let's get this solved. We don't want to see your family blow up and then we'll lose you. One thing Doyle Roth always says, we want to see you as a long-term elder, not a short-term elder. So right now, why don't you just attend to that and we'll give you our full support and you'll be back and your family will be strong. He always says that to the elders. We want long-term elders, not short-term elders. And to have long-term elders means to protect them and protect their families. Now, you say, what if there's a particular problem? For example, what if an elder's daughter gets pregnant? That does not eliminate him. He may have good children, been a good father, but that daughter could have done one thing wrong. We would not think that he would have to be removed as an elder. We'd, of course, look at the whole family situation, know that he's above reproach. His daughter, who is of age to get pregnant, has made a big mistake. She has made the mistake. Dad certainly is responsible to a sense. And we do take responsibility for our children in that age. And those kinds of sins. But that wouldn't automatically remove him as an elder. Now, he may want to step aside as an elder. For example, one of our elders wanted to step aside when his child went through a divorce. We said, hold it a second. He was just so guilty and he was so heartbroken by it. You see, your other children are all beautiful, and that child's beautiful too. That child was a good Christian girl. It was just a horrible thing that happened, and the man basically was crazy as a fruitcake and went through this ugly, ugly divorce. And we said, there is no reason for you to step aside as an elder. You are a good father. You ruled your family well. Your children all praise you. But you're not responsible for that in the sense that you need to lose your eldership. So we need to keep our heads about us. Now, the real question is this. Is there something that brings reproach in the sense that you say, you know, he has not been doing his fatherly duties. He is reproachful as a father, and there's a pattern. Listen, all my children have made mistakes, you know. But there's a pattern. There's a pattern of good family life and behavior, and the father has been involved with the children and leading the children. But they're all little sinners, you know, and they all do cuckoo things. And our children have done some things that we've gone, oh, just pray no one ever finds this out. Lord, help us, you know. Is you see the behavior of the children, that is a pattern of rebellion and of insubordination, and the father is not in control of that family. Or if he's in control of the family, he is so heavy-handed that it's not with dignity, the scripture says. They submit with dignity. If they see that, and it's an approach, and we have removed an elder, it was a good knockdown drag-out, too, over a pattern of what we saw was insubordinate behavior by his children. He didn't agree, but there were too many people complaining. So our point was, it doesn't matter whether you agree or disagree. The congregation is offended, and you're reproachful. See, he thought it was, well, it's not this, not that. And it doesn't matter what you think. People are looking at your children and say, your children are really what we don't want our children to be, and you haven't somehow haven't done the job. And he didn't see it, probably still doesn't see it. And we removed him, and he went down kicking and screaming. So that's really the issue. Is it reproachful? And I think of all our elders, in fact, it's interesting, as we pray for one another, you know what most of the prayer requests are about? The struggles of our children and our wives, and that's what most of the prayer requests are about. So all of our elders are struggling with their children. Their children are sinners. Their children have all the struggles of life, and their children go through their own heartaches, and as parents, you go through them with them, you know, and so we know that these fathers are working with their children, though, and they're involved in the process of their pain and their problems. And
all right, I think that we'll exercise our prerogative.
And you're the boss. You're the older brother. You know what the scripture says, the younger shall serve the elder.
I don't know if you know it, but Alex had severe problems with his voice. Lost it for years, and the Lord gave it back to him, and you can see the strain that goes on it. He's been talking for an hour and 45 minutes here, and
literally 4 years ago I couldn't have done this. Impossible.
So we thank the Lord that he gave him that ability back. And so tomorrow morning now, your prayer time with your prayer group leaders again, hopefully you know who they are by now, and you've developed a pattern, a long-standing pattern now of where you're going to meet and at what time. I know that varies, and that's your prerogative. So just get together tomorrow, pray for the each of us and our responsibilities for the balance of the time and whatever you've shared with each other. And we'll hear Alex one more time in the morning, and then we'll hear from each of the prayer groups about the weighty issues that you've solved for us. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much.
Good evening. What am I supposed to do?
Read it first.
Oh, okay. Hello. Okay, are we ready back there, brother? Okay. Hey, and thank you, tape people. People running the tape equipment often aren't acknowledged, and that's tough work. It is. It's tough, and it's a lot of pressure. Sometimes sound equipment does not want to cooperate for reasons no one ever understands. Should decisions in the local church be made by the elders unanimously or in a plurality format? Who gives if there is not a clear consensus? Okay, good question. I think there are decisions, there are very few ones where you need to ask for a unanimity, complete unanimity. Most decisions, you don't need that. So one thing we try to do is decide what kind of decision this is. For example, you're going to build a new building, you're going to spend lots of money, you're going to ask everyone to give. You better have complete unanimity, everyone on board, or you will just be beside yourself. You're going to change doctrine. You're going to change something that you know affects every member deeply, then we normally ask for unanimity. We just start out with that. That's the standard. However, those are very few issues. Most issues we feel are issues that we present, for example, a brother may have a burden for something. I want to try something new in the Sunday school or with the youth department. He has a burden for that. We'll give our objections. We'll share our ideas. But then we'll normally all get on board with that brother who has a desire. Let him try it. That's servant leadership. A brother feels strongly about something. He's going to lead it. He's going to try it. You say, you know, I don't think that's going to work. You give your reasons. Then you just say, well, go try it. So we're serving one another. We're submitting one to another. And that's how we reach quick consensus. Because we will all work with one another. Now, I won't even tell you what this issue is because it might cause too much stir here. But one of our brothers wanted to try an evangelistic outreach that I was really against. And if I had insisted upon it, he'd have backed down. But we always give to one another. We all know that, how we operate. So he brought it to the elders. We argued about it. We said, boy, that's just going to cause us a lot of problems. He brought it back up again, said, I have a real burden for this. I'd like to try this. I knew, why would we frustrate our brother? All we could do is fail. So we said, go ahead, try it. When people criticize, we'll just say, hey, he's the one who has the answer to that. So in most issues, we try to give to one another and let one another... But you should always speak up. This is a very important point. In the name of unity and harmony, a lot of times people will not speak up. Or if there's a brother who's been there a long time, he's a senior brother, he's got a lot of power, we'll just be quiet. That's not right. You should, on the council, always speak up. Give your reasons, give your opinion, argue for your point, but then when you need to make the decision, say, no, let's go ahead with that, let's try it. And that's how you move along, or else you're at... every issue cannot be a complete unanimity issue. You'd never do anything. And you know that if you've got good thinking men, they're going to have different ideas. So servant leadership means you serve one another, you want one another to try different things, you want to cooperate with one another. So I would say in the vast majority of decisions, you work through compromises, reach a consensus in the group that's operable for everybody and workable. Okay, so that's how we normally handle it. We just say this is not a need for an absolute unanimity. All right, second question. Should an elder continue in this capacity if he should divorce or be separated? I'm assuming that he's divorced at the time he's an elder. Well, the overarching qualification to everything is above reproach. If an elder is going through a divorce, there's just no way he can be above reproach or even separated. In fact, he's got to be an example, right? 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 3, the elder is an example. Don't rule by heavy-handedness, but be an example. Well, if you're going through a divorce or you're separated from your wife, that elder immediately needs to step aside, because we're saying your marriage is so important to us. Concentrate on your marriage. You cannot leave this congregation. So, now, maybe an elder has gone through a separation for a period of time in his marriage. Later, he could be brought back. In fact, it could be a model of how we gave complete concentration to the marriage. A divorce is a different issue. And that wasn't asked me, so. Should an elder be readmitted in this leadership capacity if he has a moral failure, is disciplined, or restored into full fellowship after the discipline is administered? How about a deacon? All right. I think that's exactly what 1 Timothy 5 is talking about when he says, lay hands suddenly on no one. Verse 22, I actually think the immediate context is the restoration of a sinning elder. And he says, don't lay hands suddenly. Now, it also applies to bringing on an elder, etc., or any kind of public appointment. It would apply to that. So 1 Timothy 5 is dealing with a sinning elder. What do you do with a sinning elder? Well, first of all, you protect them against false accusations. Verse 19, he does have protection. You can't just let any accusation go on against an elder, because he'd be, you know... If you're in anyone in any leadership position becomes a target for criticism. Anyone. So he does have some measure of protection. You have to have two or three witnesses. In fact, you're not even to listen to or entertain an accusation against an elder unless the person's willing to come forth with some kind of real evidence in that, not just rumors. And I'll tell you, one of our elders, when he was younger, I can't believe some of the accusations. We had a lady say that they were in love and going to run off with each other, telling people that. And I said to people, why are you even listening to that stuff? It's so foolish. And of course, we dealt with that sister. She was making crazy, crazy accusations against this man. Of course, if you saw this lady, no, that's not possible. You know, she was a drunk and a lot of other problems, mental problems. And so, this, for some reason, this brother had so many accusations over a period of time, and people said, oh, he's a drinker, and this and that kind of thing. Basically, when you hear those things, you should first of all say, now, you have any real evidence? You have some people that are going to stand up with you on this? If not, you say, you know, that's really serious against the leader. Or he's this and he's that. You are to protect an elder. Now, it comes true that the elder has sinned. There is some sin. Well, you are not to brush that under the carpet. An elder is treated differently than other people. It actually has to be publicly exposed. You hate to do that, but the scripture says that. It's to be known for all, that all will fear, including the elders. And so an elder's sin... whether it's a very serious sin or a little sin, it doesn't say. So any sin that is enough to be rebuked and that becomes public has to be brought forth. And in one case in our church, we just simply had the elder publicly apologize for something he did, which was very, very inappropriate and offended a lot of people, and it was sin. He publicly confessed it. There was no discipline removing him from the eldership because it was not that serious. I won't tell you what it is. But at a public gathering, he said and did some things that were very, very offensive and had sexual connotations to it. But we felt he handled it well. We brought it to the whole church so a lot of little gossip wouldn't go around. And he said, I said this and did this at this meeting, and I'm very sorry. It was very inappropriate, and it will not happen again. And that we were done with it, but we wanted to publicly deal with it. Now, there are certain sins an elder might do that he may need to be stepped aside for a time. Show the congregation that we take it seriously, and we want him to work on this area. It could even be in the way of language, or the way he speaks, and he'll step aside until the elders feel he's ready, and then you can bring him back onto the eldership. So yes, an elder can have problems that he needs to step aside for a while and then can be restored. Now, there may be certain sins that he may not be able to come back on, because he will be reproachful for a very long time. And remember, the overarching qualification above reproach, and you're going to have to ask that question, is his ministry now such that he is reproachful? And let me give you an example. There was an elder, not in our church, but another church, who fell into sexual immorality, and it was a very terrible situation that involved another woman, very destructive to another family, and I looked at that situation, and they wanted to restore him 4 or 5 years later, and they had called me, and I said, you know, I know who you're talking about, I love the guy, he's a great guy, but he happened to be in our area speaking, and I'll tell you, the whole time he was speaking, and I think I'm pretty liberal-minded in things like this, and hopefully I'm a man of grace. All I could think of is what the other woman said about him, as the other woman who was involved with sexually, she said things about him that came out publicly, and all I could think about when he was up there speaking is, these women say this man is a cad, he's a liar, he's a deceit. I don't know how that man could possibly be back in a position of leadership. He has lost trust. Now, let me give an example. You're in the United States, you're in the Senate, you're in the Congress, and you sell information to the Russians. Basically, you are never allowed back in public office. You have broken trust. Now, that doesn't mean you can't serve a country. It doesn't mean you can't serve the Lord, but you can't be back in the place of trust. You've lost trust. You know, you will not restore that, period. Remember I said to you yesterday, you get caught lying? That's pretty hard to restore, particularly if it's a certain kind of lie. You boldly lied. So I do think there are certain sins you will not be able to be back in a place of public trust. Plus, it hurts everyone else. And this idea that we've seen in our society today of pastors having these big public sins, and they're not just the sexual sin. There's the whole sin of hypocrisy and lying and all the other things that go along with them. They're not often brought up. Basically, they're through. They can serve God, they can do other things, but they cannot be back in a position of trust. And if when they're brought back in, which we're doing just so commonly today, these men hurt everybody else in that position. And by the way, we're so quick to restore people, we forget that some of these sins are sins that are often become trademarks, and the men fall back into them again. There are certain sins that show a very deep flaw of character that will probably be a lifelong weakness, which of course, C.S. Lewis said, we all have a fatal flaw. And I know a man who got caught as a pedophile, and they restored him after 4 or 5 years, and guess what? He did it again. How they could be so stupid, I don't even know, but they were that stupid. In fact, one of our men spoke in the church and filled in for him when he was gone. Brought him back in. So we know there are certain sins that are, in fact, very damning, and not only very damning, but they show a certain character trait. For example, in some of these areas, you don't put an alcoholic near alcohol or in a bar, do you? You don't put a man who has a real weakness with women back in a situation where he's around women a lot. Church work is a lot of women work. You look at who's doing a lot of the work in the church, a lot of women. You know, they have the day free, and they're great servants in the church. You have to deal with a lot of women. Well, you don't put a man who has a weakness in that area, you don't put him in there. In fact, if you have that weakness, you stay away from situations where you're over women or dealing with a lot of women. It's just stupid, because we know our weaknesses. We know where areas are weak. It's like if you have a gambling. I have no gambling problem, but there are brothers. They have a gambling problem. We have a neighbor like that. He lost his home, lost his family, and he went back and did this again. Oh, just he's got a gambling problem. Well, do you think that brother should go up to the gambling areas? No. Shouldn't buy lotto tickets or anything like that. Yes. Okay. This is a big issue today. We have a book we sell, by the way. It's in our brochure, Can a Fallen Pastor Be Restored? This is a big issue today. Read that book. That book got some good acclaim, and it got some real heavy criticism. And the point is, there are certain, when you're in a certain position of trust, when you have failed, you probably can't be put back in that position again. Okay? Doesn't mean a man can't serve Christ. It just means that that position of trust is such, you've lost trust. All right, should an elder be... I read that one. Okay, about the thing about a deacon. Yeah, a deacon, you don't put a deacon who gets caught stealing, you don't put him back in again. He's out. And this is a big problem, too. Watch your newspapers. I'm finding a couple times a year, just saw it yesterday in the paper, church where people are stealing in churches. We've had it in a couple assemblies I've been involved with. People stole in the assembly and they found out they were embezzling money, and guess what they did? The elders tried to hide it and pay it back. Guess what? It came out. How could anyone be that stupid? Of course it's going to come out eventually, and the elders are going to have mud on their face. When someone steals in the church, it's other people's money they stole. It's got to come public. Try to do with it in a gracious way. Save that person if you can, the best you can. But it has to come public immediately. You've got to do it in the right way. You might even want to say, we don't want to mention names, but money has been embezzled in our assembly. The elders are now handling it. We ask you to pray for us. If you have questions, come to the elders. Let's not gossip about it because it will make it worse. But come clean right away. And this one assembly that I was involved with in the last couple of years, they hid it. The elders hid it. They tried to protect it. I think their motives were good. It came out, basically devastated the church, and the church is almost not in existence. Because people said, well, we're giving our money, and it was a lot of money. It was embezzled over a period of years, and it couldn't basically be paid back. And they handled it wrongly. Well, what happens is you're back to the integrity, lost trust thing. Well, what kind of elders do we have here? And happened to be a relative of one of the elders. Made it even worse. He should have got out of the way immediately. It was just totally mishandled. This is not uncommon. And can I just make a comment since we're on this point? Your church handles money. Please don't be naive about that. Don't think you're safe. No church is safe in this issue. Have a backup, double, triple backup system for everyone handling money in your church. Protect yourself. Go over it every year or two. Check on how are we handling the money? What are we doing to protect ourselves? How are we protecting ourselves against a brother being put in a place of position? You know, you could have a good brother who's basically leading the finances, and 3 years down the line, he has a real temptation, a weakness, and he just starts stealing a little. He's going to put it back. Don't worry about that. He was just borrowing it. We had that actually recently in our own church, a brother borrowing money from a brother who he was working for, borrowing money from the company, which he was going to put back, and of course, got deeper and deeper, and it all came out. It was just real, real ugly, and then family all got involved and saying, well, he didn't steal. Yes, it's stealing, and they had all redefinitions of this. You take your boss's money, you're stealing. You know, they were advancing themselves pay and things like that. These things happen, and they're common. Sometimes they're just never found out, so please always review your money procedures. What about having men's meetings? What would you like me to say? Have them. Okay, is that it?
One other added question. Ability of a single man to be an elder.
Yes. People say a single man can't be an elder. The Bible doesn't say that. The Bible doesn't say he must be married. That's a different kind of statement than the statement he must be a husband of one wife. The overarching qualification, above reproach. First thing he says is he must be above reproach in his marital and sexual life. It's a one-woman kind of man. So he's making a comment on marital relationships, that it's a monogamous, faithful marriage. He's above reproach. That is not the same thing as saying you must be married. Now, you have a real problem for those who feel the Bible says he must be married. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7, there's advice saying if you can be single. It's a great way to serve the Lord with undivided devotion. But you need a proviso in there, but you'll never be able to be an elder or deacon, two of the major works in the church. Paul is calling for singleness because singleness is a great way to serve Christ. Many great single elders. You say, well, how can he handle marital problems? He doesn't have to. You got married elders, they'll handle that. John Stott was single. Robert Chapman was single. I think of so many other really great leaders of the Lord's people. Bill McDonald, of course, he wasn't an elder. Apostle Paul, yes, but if you say he wasn't an elder. I don't think the Bible teaches that singleness eliminates you from eldership. I know good people who feel that way, but I don't think it says that.
This message is continued on the other side.
Yes. Brought up what, dear brother?
The one you were opposed to. The idea of evangelism.
Oh, yes, we let him try it, and it didn't really turn out to be that good. I mean,
but the results have come in.
Yes, the results have come in, and his idea wasn't that good, and I told him it wouldn't work. What we try to do as elders is minister one to another and try to always. For example, one of our elders is over all the mission stuff, and he'll try some things and wants to spend some money on something and cost the church something, so we try to interact real heavily on that. But, you know, if he's going to be really a good missions leader and try different things, we've got to give him some rope. And he's the guy on the front line with it, and he's the guy thinking about it all the time, and so that's what we normally do, and they do that with me. I've got some ideas, and I think that I got them directly from the Lord, and the others are wondering, well, gee, man, that sounds like a dumb idea to me. Now, if I hear my brothers all against an idea, I'm going to say, well, let's just drop it. Unless they feel really strongly about it, if they say, you know, Alex, that's really not that good, and you need to think that through carefully, I'll basically probably drop it in most cases, 99.9% of cases. Jeff?
Talking about mission feeling, we had a discussion yesterday, we were talking about the shotgun approach and how your church went to the approach to mission.
Oh, yes. I'm glad you asked that question. Many years ago, about 25 years ago, we noticed something happening in our church. We noticed that we're getting too many Wycliffe missionaries. We had four or five Wycliffe missionaries. We had Youth for Christ missionaries. And we started to notice that most of our missions money was being scattered to all kinds of parachurch organizations and people we didn't know. And we said, you know, we don't like this. And we realized if we don't support our unique, distinct beliefs, Youth for Christ is not, and Wycliffe that certainly doesn't support us. In fact, they actually laugh at us. So we wanted to change our whole missions program around, and it cost us because, you know, you have family members who have kids on the field who are missionaries. But we said, if we don't change this, we got to take a stand someplace. And so we changed our whole missionary focus. We said, our missionary focus is church planting, assemblies, full Great Commission ministry. Baptizing, ministering the Lord's Supper, teaching the whole doctrine of Christ. That is the Great Commission. Wycliffe missionaries do not carry out the Great Commission. We have read through all their literature. A Wycliffe missionary is not to administer the Lord's Supper. He's not to baptize. He is not to teach the whole counsel of God. He's a philologist. He's a translator. Now, I realize when they get out in the bush, they can do whatever they want. But technically, they're not supposed to do that. So, we redirected our whole strategy. We set a vision before the church. I cannot tell you today what a great blessing that has been. We have not seen any young people go in that direction. All of our young people have gone in the direction of full Great Commission, church planning, carrying out the full doctrines as we want them carried out. Now, what we have found, Jeff, is this. Rather than sending out a lot of $50, $100 checks, we have focused on our own key missionaries and had, now here's a key word, real partnership. Partnership. Where's Bravo? I would say one third of our entire budget goes to foreign missions, and then another equal amount of money comes through in what we call designated gifts. So a total of 48% of all our money is going to foreign church planting. We have seen 8 churches planted in Indonesia through Brother Chuck Harrison, who's doing a marvelous, marvelous work out there. We are so happy with him. Well, our focus is there. Tens of thousands of dollars are going every year in that direction. And we're sending teams almost every year to Indonesia. We're going to get all our young people out to Indonesia. Well, it just gets the church really excited. We believe we are planting churches. And they're appointing elders, and they're having the Lord's Supper each week. It's our full doctrine. There wasn't one single assembly in Indonesia, fifth largest continent. Now there's almost 10 assemblies, and his goal is 50 assemblies in the next 10 years. And through our assembly and we're trying to get others involved, are raising up local evangelists there that work under his auspices to go into new villages, planting churches. In fact, this year we're going to have a challenge from our missions committee to double our giving to Indonesia, double our giving. And another thing we found, that if we set a challenge before the church comes to the fore. If we don't, that money goes out to parachurch organizations. So everyone's asking for money. We once had a missionary budget like it was real tiny. Our missionary budget's huge today. And we've never had the congregation get, oh, you're giving too much. Never. And you know, a big problem with faith. We're always looking at the full-time worker, his faith. What about the people's faith? We challenge their faith. We can give more. We can be more sacrificial. So we're going to be a big challenge this year to the congregation to double what we're doing in Indonesia to reach this goal of 50 churches, 50 assemblies in Indonesia. And we're trying to challenge assemblies in Australia, New Zealand. They're right close down there to come and help. I don't know if you know the deal in Indonesia. The first religious organization in the village is the official one. So if the Muslims are first in, which is a Muslim country, but it's an open Muslim country. If a Muslim mosque is in a village, you can't have a church. If a church is there first, they're there first. So we're trying to hit as many villages as we can with the gospel. Well, that excites the church, and I want to see people will give. They give their partners. We've been working with a church in Mexico, all Mexican brothers. No gringos down there. And we've sent teams down there. My wife just came back with a team of women that went, took a whole group of women to a hotel and spent a whole weekend with a group of sisters. One-on-one, conferencing, prayer, challenge to the women. We were 2 years ago sending like 10 men a month down there to work on building their building. And we support these assembly missionaries that are all Mexican. It's so much better. They're all Mexicans. They're all, and now this church in Tenancingo is doing so, so well, they're going to go start another church. We've built several churches in Spain. We have a Rictinier son now back in Spain. But you see, it's a total different kind of giving. We're not just sending $50 checks. We're sending $1,000 checks. We're sending $2,000 checks. We're their big supporter. And then we're networking, constantly networking. And the church is excited about this. And we're getting people on the field. Every summer we try to send out teams of young people. We help and they raise half their own money. We sent a team to Italy this summer. Sometimes we send two or three different teams. We sent several teams to Mexico. Mexico's so close. And God, people are being saved in Mexico. Man, they're being saved there. Let's get involved. It's right close. And I think it's helpful. It's healthy church when the church has world vision. We're a global people. And then it's what we just heard about, don't focus in on yourself. So I don't think it's good when you just send a check out to people you don't know. You have no commitment to them. Now, when you have commitment to missionaries, it's a different kind of thing, because it also means that you are, they feel a real deep sense of responsibility. We've yanked a couple off the field. It's just as hard to pull missionaries off the field as to get them out there. We pulled three families off the field, and we're going to pull another one off in the next year if nothing happens, because we're sending lots of money, lots of interest. And if we see nothing going on, literally nothing going on for years, we say, hey, you need to examine this. A great, great, great trap missionaries have is once a missionary, always a missionary. We don't believe in that. Do not believe in that. But missionaries on the field, people are being saved, the church is growing, something is happening, or he's laboring, but missionaries get on the field 10, 15, 20 years, they basically are done. And I've seen it. And I'm talking about my friends. I'm not talking about some people. I'm talking about people who are close to your friends to mine who will admit to you, basically, we're not doing anything. Reading two and three newspapers a day, they're not witnessing. They're basically saying, I'm 50 years old, I don't know what else to do. And we need to say to them bravely, your work is done, come back home, get a job, and I know that's hard at 50 years of age. What do you do? It's so scary that they're still sending letters. I think we have a big responsibility to help people off the field. Get them back home, their work is done, or thousands of dollars is being wasted. Now again, when you have partnerships, and you send a lot of money, you think twice about sending that. You see that hard-earned money going to someone who's doing nothing and shouldn't be there. And I think missionaries should feel that pressure of partnership. You lay hands on them. When you lay hands on a missionary, they're going to the field. When you lay hands, you're saying, we're partnering, we're sharing, we're fellowshipping. And they should feel that on the field. There's too many missionaries out there in our assembly organizations who feel no accountability. They're just getting $100 here, $50 here. No one really knows what they're doing. Every one of our missionaries gets lots of visits over the years. Lots of visits. They may get a couple a year. And they're getting teams going out there. So it's not long before we say, you know, really nothing's happening here. What are you doing all day? Bill McDonald said this to us years ago, and it stuck in my mind. And we ought to keep this in our mind. Help our missionaries. Help our full-time people. Bill McDonald said this. Very few men can fill up a whole day with work. You have a whole day. How many people can fill it up with a disciplined life of work? Most people need accountability. They need some structure. And they're out there without structure. We just brought a young lady in off the field. She was very angry. She cried. She had all her friends on her side to tell us how evil we are. But we told her, you are totally unaccountable. You will not work with the senior missionaries. And she wants to be on her own. She wants to go back on her own. We said, absolutely not. You're destroying yourself, the work. And we're not going to support that. We are not sending money to a person wandering in space out there and doing nothing. The truth is, Bill McDonald is right. Very few people have the personal discipline, personal human motivation to fill in 16 hours in a day profitably. So most people need to be in some kind of structured, accountable environment. You get a few missionaries or dynamic men. They're filling in 18 hours a day, and they can fill in other people's work. And that's why in Indonesia they've been so successful, because we've been sending people to work under Chuck Harrison. And if you can work under Chuck Harrison, you're a worker, because he is a dynamic man. Things are happening. So I believe we've got a responsibility to hold some of our missionaries accountable. It's good for them, and they need to be told by brethren, if nothing has happened, come off the field. Don't steal this money. So we've brought off 4 or 5 missionaries over the years, and it's been good. And after they come back, and they come back, and they get over the initial anger, and the family's beating the tar out of us, they all say, this was the right thing. It does take courage, because every one of the missionaries has families in the church, elders in the church, and boy, they get real angry, and they lose their rationality. That's my son out there, and he's a missionary. Yes, but he's wandering, he's treading water, he's doing nothing. And they get very angry at you. And when we changed our missions program, we had people leave, we had people come very angry at us. say we don't have any love, etc. I'm glad we did it.
Thank you.
Again, profitable time is tough to say it's over, but probably because you're here, you think this format of starting on Thursday night and going home on Saturday noon is different than we've done in the past. But you're the ones who would say, yeah, that's the right thing to do. The guys that aren't here are not here to vote. But if you think it's a good idea, let me know if you would, because future men's retreats are contingent on what's meeting the needs. Will the dogs eat the dog food? It's the test, and we're into dog food sometimes. And we've had great spiritual food here, so don't take any but conversations from that. But I know that some of us are living with the cooks, and we want to keep that peaceful. So let's hurry up there and get in line. And then when you're done eating, camp is over, or it's over if you don't want to eat. I guess you can go home then too. But hopefully you've got something to take home and work on and challenge your own elders with, if you're not one of them. I know they would profit from hearing what you've learned or think would be a good idea here. And I know five of our elders are here, and together we've already had a few conversations about things we really need to grapple with and change our perspective some. So thank you for that and challenging us with that, Alex. Let's give thanks for the food, and you can just move right on in and get in line. Father, we thank you for this discussion and for being able to see from your word the things that guide us, not only in our personal lives, but in our lives in the assembly. We thank you for the gift you've given Alex to bring these truths to us, and thank you for the Spirit working among us to convict us of these things that maybe we haven't seen before, or maybe we haven't acted on before. Make us obedient, Lord, to what our consciences tell us, and not just be able to stow it back in the back part of our mind to file it away and add to our knowledge base. We make them come to fruition, Lord, we pray. We thank you for this food now that we're about to partake of, and for those ladies that have worked to prepare it for us, the staff that has served us, for the musicians, for the tape people, Lord, all of those things that are necessary to make this thing most effective. And we thank you for each of them now, and commit each of us to you for your care on the way home, and help us in our times tomorrow that we'll be refreshed and the leaders that you want us to be among your people. In Jesus' name we ask it.